What's up, Dimes? You might have deduced from its title and the fact that it's a true crime podcast that the show will cover potentially upsetting content. In addition to detailed accounts of all manner of horrendous acts, this podcast will also entail the vital and varied use of curse words, BIPOC allyship, love for the LGBTQ plus community, using people's correct pronouns, and other pretty liberal shit. If any of that's gonna upset you, exit now. This is Trigger Warning, a true crime podcast. I'm your host, Jen O'Malley, and you've been warned. On Thursday, January 18th, 2018, the Carnival Elation left Jacksonville, Florida on a four-day round trip to the Bahamas. Tamara Tucker's family gifted the cruise to her to celebrate her 50th birthday. Tamara rarely spoiled herself, so the gift was a well-deserved treat for a woman who devoted her life to helping others. She served as a program director at Child Abuse Prevention Association, where she led policy change on both the state and national level, and as a professor for Park University, where she touched the lives of many colleagues and students, co-facilitating both the BSW and MSW programs. Tamara took care of people. She was joined on the cruise by her longtime boyfriend, 53-year-old Eric Newman. As I said, Tamara and Eric were there to celebrate. On the first evening of the cruise, the two were served a total of 21 drinks over a four-hour period, which is about 2.5 drinks per hour each. Around 11:30 p.m., Tamara headed to their cabin, G29, on the 14th deck, and Eric followed shortly thereafter. Much like buildings and many other ships, there's no named 13th deck on the Elation. Minutes after midnight, an intoxicated Tamara fell over the railing of their balcony onto the 11th deck. She died of blunt force injuries from the fall. Her toxicology report showed her blood alcohol content was 0.22%. Eric was distraught. He raced down to the 11th deck, where other passengers found him cradling Tamara's head and sobbing. Eric continued to struggle in the months after her death, using social media to write about the pain he was going through, how he longed to hold the love of his life again, and how his days were becoming more and more difficult without her. He also shared photos of them together in happy times and posted messages to Tamara online. In a Facebook group established in her memory, he said, "I miss you more than you will ever know. I hope someday soon we can be reunited. Love always and forever." Others rushed to comfort Eric in his grief, which is fucking disgusting since he was arrested and charged with Tamara's murder in September of that year. Initially, Newman claimed innocence, but eventually confessed that he and Tamara had argued when he'd returned to their cabin, so he strangled her and pushed her off the balcony to her death. Unbeknownst to Tamara's family, and perhaps even to her, it's unclear, Newman had four prior misdemeanor convictions for domestic violence. Three of those involved allegations of battery against two women he'd been in relationships with, his ex-wife and his ex-fiancée. The convictions included allegations of strangulation, further illustrating that he had serious issues with self-control. Newman was also charged with driving under the influence on Christmas Eve in 1994, an especially thoughtful night to put other people's loved ones at risk. In December 2019, Newman pleaded guilty to one count of murder in the second degree for killing Tamara with malice aforethought, defined as the intention to kill or harm, which is held to distinguish unlawful killing from murder. He was sentenced to 12 years in federal prison with 5 years of post-release supervision. He was also forced to pay almost $8,500 in restitution to Tamara's family. Not that I'd turn it down, but I find that insulting in the extreme to her family. Tamara's trademark long red hair was donated to Locks of Love. Even in death, she was still helping people. If you thought the last guy was a piece of shit, hang on to your tits, because this next one sounds like he was a real dick even without alcohol. On Sunday, July 23rd, 2017, high school sweethearts Christy and Kenneth Manzanares, who were married at 17, boarded the Emerald Princess for a week-long Alaskan cruise to celebrate their 18th wedding anniversary. They were joined by their three daughters, ages 13 to 22, and Christy's family. 2 days later, Kenneth was drinking heavily, being obnoxious and behaving so badly at dinner that one of Christy's brothers spoke up about it. Christy, Kenneth, and two of their daughters left dinner at that point and headed back to their cabin, D726, on the 9th deck. Once there, they began arguing about Kenneth's behavior, and Christy told him that she knew he'd find a way to ruin the trip, and she was done. She wanted him to disembark in Juneau and fly back home to Utah alone. When the topic of divorce came up, Kenneth told their daughters to leave the room. According to court documents, Both children left the cabin, walked to their grandparents' adjoining cabin, and upon entering, they listened to their parents' conversation and then heard a loud noise and Christy screaming. The two children attempted to open the door connecting the cabins and were unable to enter. "Dad, stop! I can hear you!" the couple's youngest daughter, Kaya, shouted. He yelled back, "Do not come in here! I mean it!" The girls ran through the other cabin to the balcony, where they saw their father straddling their mother on the bed, beating her with his fists. They banged on the glass and screamed at him to stop, but he looked right at them and carried on, using his fists like hammers on their mother's face. The girls ran for help, banging on the cabin doors of their other family members. Finally, they got their uncle, Dallas Hunt. Even with a key, they couldn't get into the room, so Dallas ran back to his room and climbed from his balcony to Christie's to try to help. Kenneth and the cabin were covered in blood. Christy was unrecognizable. Dallas asked what Kenneth had done, and he responded, "She wouldn't stop laughing at me." He then grabbed Christy's arms and tried to drag her to the balcony, presumably to throw her overboard, but Dallas caught her ankles and pulled her back into the cabin. Christy's youngest daughter cradled her mother as she lay dying on the floor. Security and medical personnel arrived, restrained Kenneth, and tried to revive Christy to no avail. She died of blunt force trauma to the head, including multiple skull fractures. Kenneth admitted what he'd done to the FBI, saying, "My life is over. His life. Fucker." Kenneth's defense argued that his and Christy's marriage had been long and happy and that this single instance of violence should be attributed to Kenneth's supposed IQ of 80, brain injuries from playing contact sports, including boxing, American football, and wrestling, undiagnosed bipolar disorder, medication that he'd taken, including Adderall, testosterone, amphetamine-like weight loss drugs, opioid pain medication, and a drug used for erectile dysfunction, and alcohol, and they asked for a reduced sentence of 7.5 years. But the prosecution pointed out that Kenneth did indeed have a history of what the court deemed domestic abuse. It seems he had a nasty habit of intimidation via temper tantrum, breaking remote controls, punching holes in walls and furniture, restraining Christy by the shoulders and forcing her to sit, etc. They contended that the rage-fueled attack, witnessed by the couple's daughters, was intentional, triggered by Christy telling Kenneth she was done, she wanted a divorce, and she wanted him off that ship. In February 2020, Kenneth Manzanares pleaded guilty to one count of murder in the second degree and was sentenced to 30 years in prison on Friday, June 4, 2021. A little over a month later, around 7 a.m. on Wednesday, July 14, 2021, he was found unresponsive in his cell at Lemon Creek Correctional Center in Juneau, Alaska, and could not be revived. A statement from the Department of Corrections indicates no foul play is suspected. The death is not COVID-19 related. As of today, I cannot find any cause of death or updated information for Kenneth Manzanares. Let's take another cruise on the Carnival Elation, shall we? I said that as a segue, but I have cruised on the Elation. It was in September 2019, before I knew about the case, thankfully, or I would have gone full weirdo mode trying to get a peek inside that cabin, or standing on the 11th deck under its balcony, and probably been removed from the ship. Speaking of getting a peek inside the cabin, if you'd like one, MLB Destinations on YouTube stayed in that cabin during her October 2019 trip and provides a video tour on her channel. Shirley Longstreet and Robert McGill were high school sweethearts who broke up and went their separate ways like normal people. But 30 years later, they reconnected online before their class reunion. They got married in Vegas in 2003 and from all accounts were overjoyed to be together. This, like Tamara Tucker's, was to be a celebratory cruise. Shirley's birthday and retirement, Bob's birthday and his pending retirement. They'd spent a lovely day, his actual birthday, Tuesday, July 14th, 2009, with two other couples in Cabo San Lucas, Mexico. When one of those couples came upon Bob sitting on deck alone with a bucket of beers and smoking a cigar, they asked if Shirley was okay. Probably expecting to hear that she was tired or seasick, they were shocked when Bob responded with, "No, she's dead. She's dead. I killed her." It was then that they noticed his busted knuckles. The couple immediately reported the situation to Carnival Cruise Line security, who then approached McGill on deck. According to the Los Angeles Daily News, "Life is mystery," McGill reportedly said. "Bring me to the brig or security office and check my cabin, R24. Security officers found a privacy please sign on the locked doorknob, and inside was Shirley McGill's body in a pool of blood on the bathroom floor, with blood splattered around the cabin. McGill told a Carnival investigator he had argued with his wife and punched her once in the stomach. From the Elation brig, he admitted to the captain he'd killed his wife, but said he didn't know why. Shirley had not provoked the attack. According to the FBI, During the interview, McGill called his son and said, "Is it on TV yet? I killed Shirley by accident." Well, not by accident. I'll tell you all about it. What he'd actually done was beaten and strangled his wife and left her to die. In court, McGill pleaded guilty to second-degree murder and apologized for his actions, but did not explain them. Paul White, McGill's friend of over a decade, said that McGill has not even offered an explanation to him in any of their letter writing over the course of 2 years. He just always said to me, "There's more to this story than has been reported." Okay then, fucking tell it. I absolutely despise that shit. "Oh, there's more to the story," or "if you knew what really happened." Okay then, if it's so life-changing or exculpatory, out with it, bitch. Damn. McGill's defense asked for a sentence of barely more than 11 years since he was a good person. Y'all, that's another thing I could go without hearing ever again about someone who intentionally killed another being not in self-defense. Well, joke's on him because he got sentenced to life. Assistant U.S. Attorney Jason Forge said it best. Whatever decency Mr. McGill had, he left on the floor of that bathroom next to Shirley's beaten, bleeding, and broken body. That's like when rapists get out on work release because they've shown good character. Next. Lonnie Kakontas met Mickey Kanasaki while working at a Los Angeles law firm where he was an attorney and she was a paralegal. They were married in 1995. She was his second wife, but divorced in 2002, shortly after Lonnie was charged with having sexual contact with a minor. The divorce was allegedly obtained to protect certain assets from potential civil litigation against Lonnie, and he and Mickey continued to live together as a couple in their Ladera ranch home. Nevertheless, according to CruiseBrews.com, their relationship deteriorated, and on several occasions, local law enforcement officers were called to the couple's home due to altercations in which Mickey allegedly became physically abusive towards Lonnie. One of the incidents resulted in Mickey being arrested and charged with bodily injury and battery. Mickey eventually attended a court-ordered domestic violence program. Susan McQueen, a private investigator and girlfriend of Lonnie's best friend, Bill Price, also a PI and former cop, said that Mickey became nasty and embarrassing when she drank, and after a few double dinner dates with the couple, Susan decided a few was quite enough. Lonnie met Amy Nguyen in 2002 through a dating website, and they began an intimate relationship of which Mickey was unaware. He and Mickey ended things in 2005, at which time Lonnie and Amy got married in Vegas. So many themes this episode. And they bought a house in Orange County. In September of that year, Lonnie filed a motion to have Mickey legally forced to sell their home in Ladera Ranch. Lonnie wanted the money for his half of the $700,000 home, but Mickey didn't want to sell or move out. She suffered from severe arthritis and couldn't work as a paralegal anymore, so had turned to investing, which proved lucrative. Mickey was the one who'd paid off the mortgage, so she didn't feel that Lonnie was entitled to any part of the house. Lonnie eventually withdrew the motion, moved back into the Ladera Ranch house with Mickey, and divorced Amy. Lonnie and Mickey reconciled with plans to remarry, and as part of that plan, they updated their wills, making each the executor and sole beneficiary of the other's estate. Lonnie, notoriously frugal and not prone to vacationing, put a lot of effort into finding and booking the perfect getaway to symbolize the rekindling of his and Mickey's romance, a Mediterranean cruise not even marketed in the States. Mickey was impressed. They invited Bill Price and Susan McQueen to join them, but for reasons mentioned earlier, they declined. The cruise required the couple to travel to Minnesota, then London, then Spain, to board a budget-level, no-frills converted ferry, the Island Escape, formerly the Star Dancer. On Tuesday, May 23, 2006, they sailed to Italy, where Mickey and Lonnie enjoyed an all-day excursion in Sicily. They went to dinner, where they ordered a bottle of wine, followed by a trip to the casino, a show, and then back to their room, Balcony Cabin 9579, where they finished off the wine from dinner. Lonnie was still jet-lagged, so he took an Ambien, and Mickey popped back out to get herself a cup of tea. On Friday, May 26, 2006, Lonnie woke up around 4:30 a.m. to find that Mickey wasn't in their cabin. He realized that her bed hadn't been slept in. Wait, separate beds on this romantic cruise Lonnie'd put so much research into? So he went looking for her around the ship. He couldn't find her, so reported her missing around 5 a.m. When the ship docked in Naples, Italian police boarded the vessel and secured cabin 9579. They found an empty wine bottle in the trash, but nothing seemed out of place. Mickey couldn't be found anywhere, so everyone assumed she'd gone overboard sometime in those early morning hours. Lonnie was put up in a Naples hotel but flew back to the U.S. and to Amy Wynn just a day later without informing the local police. Surprising everyone, Mickey's body, clad in a blue tee and green pajama pants, was found floating in the Mediterranean Sea off the coast of Paola by a research vessel mere hours after Lonnie left the country. Lonnie sold the Ladera Ranch house and was the beneficiary of those proceeds, as well as the funds in his and Mickey's bank account, plus life insurance, retirement, and other investment accounts. Meanwhile, an autopsy had been done on Mickey's body. Her lungs were completely free of water, and you know what that means, Dimes. She didn't enter the water alive. She also had severe hemorrhaging around her neck, consistent with strangulation, and a skull fracture. The pathologist, Dr. Ricci, said that the injuries to the base of Mickey's neck were from a violent action that was continued on for a period of time. The head injury was caused by an object with a convex surface. You know, convex. Like a bottle of wine. The FBI opened an investigation into Mickey's death and a federal grand jury investigation was convened in district court in December 2006, but no indictment was issued. There are several reasons for that, but note that both Amy and Bill testified in support of Kokontis. I have to be honest with y'all. This episode was supposed to be a quick, lighter break from the super heavy shit we started with. But this man has been behaving as if the law does not apply to him since before I was born, and sorting through all of his nonsense and trying to make it make sense has taken far too long, and I'm feeling overwhelmed. While I want to give you the best show that I can and provide as much detail and information as possible, at this point I feel like all his bullshit is taking away from what happened to Mickey. I find this little man tedious. So, since I am the boss of me in podcast land, I've decided to wrap it up. I'm going to give you the conclusion and point out a couple things you may want to look into yourself, but otherwise, we will be spending no more of our precious time on this odious creature. By January 2008, Kokontis was married to Catherine Kern, his fourth wife, and living in Florida. To summarize, he did some sketchy money stuff and the FBI, who hadn't given up, brought it to the attention of the Orange County District Attorney's Office. The government seized over $1.2 million, and all but $250,000 of it remained tied up in litigation. To top that off, he couldn't practice law in Florida, since he'd been to prison in the 70s. There's one of those things you can delve into more if you're interested. At some point between 2006 and 2013, Kokontis pissed off Bill real bad. Whether Bill actually knew some shit or he's just a petty bitch, he turned against Kokontis and got Amy to turn with him. Bill convinced Amy by telling her that Kokontis said she was a whore and only good because she took it up the ass. That resulted in another grand jury being convened. Amy was given immunity, and she basically testified that everything she'd said to the initial grand jury was a lie, down to how she'd originally said that Kokontis had slept on her couch when he got back from Italy, but they'd actually had comfort sex. Huh. Chicken soup for the dick. She also said that her and Kokontis' quick divorce was part of the murder plan, that with Mickey gone, they'd be free to live off the money from the sale of her assets. Amy claimed Kokontis had told her that his buddy Bill was going to arrange for Mickey to be thrown overboard on the cruise, and that Bill and Susan would then be his alibi. But they ended up not going on the cruise, so Kokontis took matters into his own hands. Bill told investigators that nothing mattered more to Kokontis than money and sex. He claimed that, before booking the cruise, which had apparently been Bill's idea, Kokontis had asked him about security features on cruise ships, like surveillance cameras and such. Then Kokontis chose a cruise, remember, one that wasn't even marketed in America, that had no surveillance at all, and where every balcony cabin had a direct drop to the water. Here are a few more things you might want to look up. How, while in jail, Kokontis was charged with soliciting the murder of Amy to keep her from testifying against him. How he almost caused Susan McQueen to lose her PI license. And, as to the sexual encounter with a minor mentioned at the beginning of this section, how Lonnie allegedly intimidated and threatened her to prevent her from testifying, then sued her family. I don't know where he got the audacity, but he needs to put it back. Fucking finally, in June 2020, 14 years after Mickey was reported missing, Kokontis was convicted of one count of first-degree murder with a special circumstances enhancement of murder for financial gain. He was sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. Phew, okay, this is the last one, and we're staying on the same ship. The Star Dancer was Sundance Cruises' only vessel. Sundance merged with Eastern Cruise Line to form Admiral Cruises. Then Star Dancer became the Royal Caribbean Viking Serenade when Admiral was merged with them. In 2002, the ship was renamed Island Escape and operated 7-day Mediterranean cruises, with which we are all now very familiar. At 3 a.m. on Saturday, February 13, 1988, the last night of their honeymoon cruise, 36-year-old Dr. Scott Roston informed Stardancer staff that his bride of 9 days, 26-year-old Karen, had gone overboard. When asked what happened, he first said she'd been blown off the track where they'd both been running. Dimes, I have a feeling we're making the exact same face right now. Deemed highly improbable since the sea was calm and wind velocity wasn't above 5 miles per hour, Scott then posited that Karen had fallen off and he'd tried to catch her but missed. His wife was 5'3", and the railings were 3.5 feet high. Try again, sir. Scott mustered up all his doctorly brain power and decided on this explanation. Israeli agents had murdered his beloved wife as retribution for the searing exposé he'd written about their government's crimes the year before. He was referring to a book he wrote, Nightmare in Israel, which he paid Vantage Press to publish in early 1987. The book is about how, supposedly, Scott and his parents emigrated to Israel in 1978, where he opened an unlicensed chiropractic clinic. After he refused to be bribed into marrying a neighbor's niece, he was arrested on a false charge of having beaten up and robbed a member of the neighbor's family. He was kept in jail and a mental hospital for over 2 months in 1979, being drugged and brutalized. All of this was done at the behest of the Israeli mafia. His book sold one lonely little copy. I guess those Israeli agents bought it. This next bit was published in the November 24th, 1995 edition of New Law Journal, and I'm going to read it to you exactly as it was written because it's perfect. In March 1987, about the time of the publication of Nightmare in Israel, sheriffs of Palm Beach County, Florida, received a report from Roston's parents about an attempt to kidnap their son outside a shopping mall. According to Roston, two Israelis in a white van grabbed him and proclaimed in Hebrew, "Israel wants you." Roston said he broke free and shot one of his would-be captors before speeding away in his Toyota. "Israel took its best shot," Roston told the Palm Beach Post, "and they blew it." What in the Magnum P.I. Miami Vice Knight Rider wannabe is this? A white van? How 80s is that? I can't even think about anyone speeding away in a Toyota without picturing a spoiler and hearing That incident was not investigated because Scott's statements could not be confirmed. Anyway, much like you, me, and the Palm Beach County Sheriffs, the authorities investigating Karen's disappearance also thought that Dr. Scott Roston was full of shit, especially when Karen's body was found that afternoon in Pacific waters 30 miles southwest of San Diego, California. Karen's body was kept afloat by air trapped in her clothing. Medical examiners stated that had she attempted to swim after entering the water, the air would have been forced out of her clothes. Therefore, she must have been unconscious when she went into the water. She had subsequently died from drowning. The hemorrhaging in her neck and eyes, combined with the warping of her neck bones, were evidence of manual strangulation. Material from the rubberized jogging track embedded in her clothing suggested that she had been pressed to the deck with considerable force. Another passenger on the ship, an assistant chief deputy in the Cook County, Illinois Sheriff's Department, went for a stroll that morning and found parts of earrings and strands of strawberry blonde hair that appeared to have been yanked out, which he reported to ship officials. They were 11.5 feet from the railing where Karen went overboard. Passengers were questioned about their interactions with and observations of Karen and Scott, and several recounted episodes of tension. One person who shared a table with the couple said that Scott was angry with Karen because she ate sweets and didn't know which eating utensils to choose from the complex silverware settings. Another passenger had seen the chiropractor arguing with a woman about 45 to 60 minutes before he reported his wife overboard. Did I mention that Roston had triangular gouges and a 4-inch scratch on his face? He claimed that he had hit his head on a gangway control box, but no blood, hair, or marks were found on that box, and photos showed that there were no sharp parts on the box that could have caused those injuries. That's right. It seems like Karen scratched the shit out of him. Good job. Roston was arrested when the ship docked in Los Angeles and charged with second-degree murder. His trial began in February 1989, and his defense attorney, David Kenner, opened by pointing out that there were two Israeli men aboard the Stardancer. Roston's claims, he conceded, may at first blush appear impossible, contrived, unbelievable. But these kinds of things do happen in the world of international intrigue. Okay, settle down there, Perry Mason. If a person hadn't been murdered, this entire thing would be laughable. The defense launched no argument, made no effort to overcome the prosecution's medical evidence or the testimony of fellow passengers about the newlywed shipboard squabbles. The only evidence they introduced was the presence of the two Israeli nationals on board the ship, but claimed that they couldn't reach either of them. The prosecution surprised the shit out of Kenner when they called Maurice Haziza, one of the two Israeli passengers, to the stand. He testified that he was not a secret agent for the Israeli government, but a wedding photographer on vacation. He and his traveling companion, Emil Yaron, had gone to Disneyland and Universal Studios before embarking on the Mexico cruise to complete their vacation after photographing the wedding of a friend. That sounds like something a secret agent would say. Ralston was found guilty and sentenced to life without parole. At the sentencing hearing, the court observed that the forensic evidence collected from the ship's upper deck, as well as the condition of Karen's body, showed that she was severely beaten and strangled before her body was thrown overboard. Ralston appealed, and while the conviction was upheld, sentencing had to be revisited because the trial court had handed down the sentence for first-degree murder, not second-degree. However, during the appeal, it was discovered that what actually happened in Israel was Ralston had attempted armed robbery and feigned mental illness to avoid prosecution. Because of that, he was not entitled to be regarded as a first-time offender. The court concluded that Ralston's criminal history was not adequately represented by Category 1 and that Ralston was a dangerous person with a propensity to commit further crimes. Meanwhile, the head of the California Chiropractors Association said Ralston, who had been identified as a chiropractor by his mother and roommate, was not licensed to practice either in California or Florida, where he'd previously lived. This man does not exist in the annals of chiropractics. In November 1994, Dr. Looney Tunes was resentenced to a term of 33 years, 9 months, for the murder of Karen Waltz Ralston. I'll let you decide, dear listener, whether this episode was about shit that happened on ships, useless pieces of shit that happened to be on ships, shits that can't hold their shit on ships, or all of the above. This was by no means an exhaustive list either way. The ocean is vast, and so are the depths of human depravity. That's it for today, y'all. I want to shout out my latest patron, my mama, Judy. She likes the show, even though I use F-bombs. Please do me a solid and be sure to tap follow on whatever platform you're using to listen to the show. Thank you so much, as always, for listening. Come back next week for your true crime fix.